Christmas. I don't want to fight tonight with.
This week, we spotted the rarest of beasts in Washington, D.C., a bipartisan moment, and just in time for the holidays.
Just proves that when people trust each other, you can sit down and get legislation that's good for the country.
Although it was a difficult negotiation session, what we came out with in the end was a good bill.
A brand new approach to dealing with narcotics in this country, and a new approach when it came to dealing with prisoners in our country. It is a breakthrough.
Merry Christmas, I don't want to fight tonight with. Merry Christmas, I don't want to fight tonight with. Merry Christmas, I don't want to fight tonight with.
On Tuesday, the Senate overwhelmingly passed one of the most significant changes to the country's criminal justice system in decades. The bipartisan First Step Act improves conditions for prisoners, expands programs to decrease recidivism, and perhaps most notably, reforms sentencing. It comes decades after Congress implemented draconian drug laws and sentencing around crack and cocaine that disproportionately incarcerated poor Americans and Americans of color. And it also led to an explosion of the prison population in the United States.
We were scared to death of crack cocaine, which was now showing up all over America. We created a 100-to-1 disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine sentencing. The net result of that, we thought, would be to scare America straight in terms of the danger of this drug, and it backfired.
Democratic Senator Dick Durbin was one of the major forces behind the bill, along with Republican Senators Mike Lee of Utah and Chuck Grassley of Iowa, the Senate Judiciary Committee chairman. So where are we now? That's the first question on The Takeaway. Inamai Chatiar is director of the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and she joins me live in the studio. Inamai, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, what are the broad strokes of this Criminal Justice Reform Act?
So the First Step Act basically does three things. So one, it improves prison conditions, which are very inhumane. Second, it has an ability for prisoners to participate in specific programming and then earn their way toward shorter sentences and early release. And then third, and most importantly, it actually has very robust federal sentencing reform. So it reduces mandatory minimums for certain drug crimes and then allows judges to depart from those mandatory minimums in certain cases.
So let's go back for a second to the conditions that led to the need for this, which we sort of touched on in the introduction here. Lawmakers who were announcing the bill cited the war on drugs. I recall it. I've lived through it. For those who didn't, what was that? Tell us what happened there.
So in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, lawmakers across the country, Democrats and Republicans in Washington and in states, enacted very draconian, harsh criminal laws and sentencing laws that not only increased criminal penalties, but also made sentences dramatically long. And that has resulted in the United States being the largest incarcerator in the world. So we have 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. And the prison population is disproportionately black and brown people.
So the thing that was most, I think, interesting for a lot of folks was that this was a bipartisan effort. And I'm wondering, how did we get to this bipartisan effort? What was it that prompted these parties to work together?
So the politics on this issue are actually very fascinating. So in about 2007, some Republicans in states, particularly starting in Texas, due to the fiscal crisis and the state budget crunch, started looking at ways to reduce the prison population. So Texas was the first state to do that. It was bipartisan, but it was Republican-led. And then that went state by state. And then we saw a very small decrease in the prison population based on that. And so in about 2015, this effort came to Washington, where you had Dick Durbin and Chuck Grassley introduced the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. And there was a strong bipartisan coalition around that bill. It ended up actually not passing, mainly due to Jeff Sessions and Tom Cotton, who were very against the idea of releasing prisoners.
So we know now the Sessions is obviously no longer in that role. So was that one of the stopgaps that was removed, you think, to really move this forward?
I think that was part of it. So after that bill died, then you had the president enter into office and appoint Attorney General Sessions. And they used a lot of really terrible crime rhetoric. And so I think people were unsure about where this administration was going to go. And at some point, you had Jared Kushner, who was very dedicated to this cause, come in and really talk to the president about the need for criminal justice reform. Because Jeff Sessions was there, it seemed that sentencing reform was a non-starter. But once he did leave, I don't think it was a coincidence that sentencing reform was then included into this bill.
I also want to ask a question. You mentioned Jared Kushner, but there's also, and this is not a joke, Kim Kardashian has met with the president a couple of times to discuss clemency and getting folks out of long-term sentencing. So do you think that also played into this? I mean, just the fact that this is becoming a bigger issue outside of politics?
I think so. I mean, I think that the idea of people like Kim Kardashian, who have a lot of public power to be talking about this, is very important. I think there was a very concerted effort to push the president through her, through Jared, even through people like the Koch brothers, who were really pressuring the president.
And let's talk a little bit about this. We're talking about federal system, not state and local jails. Is that right?
Right. So about 85% of prisoners are at the state level. So this doesn't affect them. However, to have this play out in Washington in this bipartisan way really helps create the public and political support for states to go further.
And is there an expectation that states will go further now that they've seen this at the federal level?
I think that's what we're hoping. And I do think that you will see that playing out. I mean, one thing to note on that is this bill, which provisions were considered moderate in 2016, is now being labeled Trump's criminal justice reform bill. So
which is good for the president.
Which is good for the president, but also really good for the cause, because that means that politicians can't be offering these types of proposals if they're trying to be progressive or reform-minded. So I do think you will see politicians trying to make broader changes at the state level.
Inamai Chatiyar is director of the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
For Washington, D.C., the First Step Act could have an especially big impact. Tony Lewis Jr. is an activist and author based in D.C. and an expert on reentry. Tony, thanks for joining the show.
So happy to be here. Thank you.
So what is it about Washington, D.C. That makes it unique for people in the criminal justice system?
In D.C., we do not have a state-run or city-run prison system. So the Federal Bureau of Prisons becomes the destination for any individual that breaks a local law or a federal law. So that makes us the only place in America where if you commit a local crime, you do your sentence in the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
Now, when you heard about the First Step Act, were there specific parts of that act that you thought would directly influence D.C.?
What jumped out at me the most was the 500-mile radius recommendation. Like I said, all of the D.C. inmates are in the federal system, so therefore they can be all across the country. I remember growing up, my father, when he first went to prison in 89, his first 13 years of his sentence, he was in a place called Lompoc, California, which is 3,000 miles away. So I thought about the families here in D.C. that would at least have their loved one to be in a 500-mile drivable range from Washington. So that made me excited. Though 500 miles is still pretty far for a poor family, it's closer than being in California or Louisiana or New Mexico, Colorado, etc.
Tony, what's the importance of proximity?
Yeah, I always tell people to just think about the people that you love and imagine if they were thousands of miles away and you couldn't get to see them and what that would do. And we all know that familial bonds as it relates to inmates are very important with inmate behavior and, more importantly, recidivism. People that are connected to their families tend to do better when they return to the community. They want those familial bonds help motivate them and help them want to change their lives. So the more we can maintain those bonds and keep people connected, the better chances we have of impacting recidivism.
And of course, one of the things that this is also trying to address is reentry. What happens after a person comes out of the criminal justice system? Was there anything in the bill that stood out to you about reentry, or was there something missing?
Well, I do like the fact that we're going to expand training and education, but in what is my question? I think we need to really target growth industries. Working in reentry, I don't see people coming home from the federal system with up-to-date skill set, a skill set that can make them competitive. So when we talk about successful reentry, we know that having an in-demand skill is paramount.
Are you thinking about efforts like Ban the Box, which was something that was really popular and at least had somewhat bipartisan support a couple of years ago? Or are you thinking about other things that could be done?
Sure. Ban the Box was, again, like this bill, a good first step, but it doesn't necessarily do the job because people still have to get a background check at some point. And I'm not saying do away with background checks, but what I am saying is that we have to have a more comprehensive hiring process that looks at people on a case-by-case basis. No blanket, no felony provisions. We have to have people look at individuals and the steps that they've taken since they made their crime. And also we have to look at rational relationship between crime and job that they're applying for and have those factors play a part in the consideration of hiring individuals. And I really think we can't go to the business community at the end. We have to have them as a part of this conversation from the beginning.
Were you encouraged by the fact that this had both Democrat and Republican support?
Yes. I was very happy that there was some bipartisan collaboration. But what I will say is this, when we talk about some, particularly the sentencing reforms that went into this bill, and only one of those sentencing reforms being retroactive around the crack cocaine disparity, which will bring about 3,000 individuals home, which is a great achievement. But I feel like those other reforms need to be retroactive as well. If we have bipartisan support that things are wrong around sentencing, if it's wrong today, it was wrong then. So there are people languishing in jail for the last, you know, two or three decades that would not be sentenced to life without parole if they were sentenced today based on this bill. So I think we can't really worry about what it's going to do to the judicial system or how it's going to hold up the courts. If we have to appoint more judges, then we should do that. But I think we have to truly be committed to undoing the wrongs of our justice system.
Tony Lewis Jr. is an activist and an expert on reentry and the author of Slug, A Boy's Life in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Tony, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a wonderful holiday.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.